You're listening to Grace Saves All, the podcast which exists at the spiritual intersection of Christianity and universal salvation. In this podcast, we will be exploring an ancient and modern approach to Christianity, which affirms both that grace saves alone and that grace goes to all. And now, here is David Artman, author of Grace Saves All, The Necessity of Christian Universalism.
Happy to welcome back to the Grace Saves All podcast, Dr. David Bentley Hart.
Hello. Well, I feel like I dropped my prompt there. So, yes.
Well, Dr. Hart, I've been alarmed about the rise of fascism in the United States. Robert Paxton, arguably the world's leading scholar on fascism, has now said that, quote, "Trump's incitement of the invasion of the Capitol on January 6, 2020 removes my objection to the fascist label. His open encouragement of civic violence to overturn an election crosses a red line. The label now seems not just acceptable, but necessary." So to begin with, Dr. Hart, do you concur with Paxton's assessment that Donald Trump is a fascist? And what would you say to the large swath of American Christianity which enables Trump and which still stands behind him?
I think that there's nothing even remotely controversial about the label. If anything, it's too weak. If one's looking for a real historical parallel, given his use of immigrants, their detention, torture, and illegal imprisonment in a foreign gulag, we're moving more in the realm of Nazism. Fascism, if you're being historically specific, the Italian movement has many of the same authoritarian tendencies, but we should be looking a little bit further north than the Italian Alps. There is no question that this is a profoundly evil, authoritarian, and racist government that uses terrorism and extra-legal coercions at every possible level of society and in every possible way to enforce power over a population. What I would say to the Christians who are on the Trump bandwagon is that they are now contra cur, no doubt, accomplices of the spirit of Antichrist in history and doing the work of Satan, that this is not even a remotely plausible political decision on the part of someone who claims to follow Christ. It is the embrace of basically a satanic view of human nature and of human polity.
Now, I can understand why some of them might have been drawn to Trump because they were pro-life or because they thought LGBTQ and trans rights had gone too far, and maybe they felt like there needed to be a much more aggressive enforcement of our immigration policies, and maybe they felt that America was losing its Christian identity and the Democrats were flawed, and that they, as conservatives, as Christians, were under attack by liberals and in the media. Mm-hmm. But in supporting Trump, they have aligned themselves with a law-breaking, violent, anti-democratic, fascist movement. And in so doing, they have sacrificed far more than what they have gained. And I'm struck by you're saying that they have aligned themselves with the Antichrist with
the Antichrist. I don't believe in an Antichrist as such. I think that's a mystery. But yes, they've aligned themselves with the spirit of Antichrist. That is that, I mean, if you're going to talk about fascism, you have to talk about it in many modalities. There is a political history there. There's an economic history that goes back principally to the 18th century. But there's a spiritual history, too, that goes back further, and which throughout most of Christian history has tended to express itself in anti-Semitism and other vices, but that in the age of the nation state has become what we in the classical sense could define as fascism, or in the modern, the 20th century sense. And that's definitely what this is. But I mean, you know, I understand none of what you just said, to be honest. I mean, I understand it intellectually, and I understand that these are motives, and there is such a thing as invincible ignorance. And I would like, you know, part of me, the angry part of me wants to say, well, the only reason someone would support Trump is he's either very stupid or very evil or very psychotic or all three things at once. I think that's what we call the Rob Dreher trifecta. But at the end of the day, I realize that they're very good people who are not so much stupid as just ignorant of the meaning of their actions and inattentive to what's going on, no matter how spectacularly obvious it should seem to them. Whatever the case, whatever they think they gained, first of all, Trump's not pro-life, I mean, for God's sake. I mean, he even changed the Republican platform to the 12-week limit. That would just be codifying Roe versus Wade. So, I mean, even that rather thin veil doesn't actually conceal the reality anymore. The Republican Party platform now, as a result of Trump, it doesn't incorporate that kind of pro-life language in it. But so what? And the rest I'm not sympathetic to at all. But I mean, it's the old question, you know, what profit a man to gain the world and lose his soul? Of course, evil presents itself to you in an attractive way. It appeals not only to your reptile brain, but it often, you know, knows how to wrap itself in the appearance of what you consider the good or the virtuous, the true patriotism, piety, the politics of life, whatever. When at the end of the day, it is still evil and you've simply been conned.
Well, I know that some of the people that have contacted me have been disappointed that I'm being so hard on Trump and labeling him a fascist, have said, well, the Biden administration was fascist because it had vaccine mandates and tried to push people around.
Very stupid people. I'm sorry, those are very stupid people who say, I mean, the truth is, first of all, the vaccines were not harmful. You know, we're talking about the COVID vaccines. Vaccines are a good thing, but there is such a thing as public health. And for vaccines to work, there has to be a vaccinated population. That's what real herd immunity is. It isn't this ridiculous Darwinian algorithm that someone like RFK Jr. believes in. If you let enough children die of measles, that somehow the human race will become immune to measles. Public health require, and those, and to be honest, those who didn't want to take the vaccines not only foolish, but doing something very wicked, and they should have been sort of confined to their houses with red X's painted on their doors. You know, I have no sympathy for that. And that is simply the exercise of a necessary executive prerogative in the service of public health. There is no excuse for anyone regarding that as an imposition upon their liberties. It also is, even if you believe that that's somehow too authoritarian, it doesn't even begin to rise to the level of the least vicious of what we've seen come from the Trump administration in just 5 months. I mean, believe me, by the end of his term in office, there will be nothing left of whatever liberties, whatever democratic freedoms, whatever moral decency people like to think that the society at one time had and cherished. We're at the end of the story with this man.
Well, there are some who still think that the fascist label doesn't apply because Trump was elected and because what we see now doesn't yet look like what happened in Germany. But fascism is more an ideology than a political party that always acts in exactly the same way. And one of the projects of fascism is even to steal our language and thereby our ability to accurately diagnose what's happening. So if we can't admit that America has a case of fascism on its hands, then we won't act to seek the remedy. If we don't believe we are sick with fascism, we won't seek a cure.
Mm-hmm. Well, obviously, what fascist leader wasn't elected I mean, I'm not quite sure how that tells it. Democracies always kill themselves by electing an authoritarian leader. Hitler in the early 30s was, you know, he hadn't attempted the final solution yet, but do we doubt that he was everything a Nazi is? I mean, and he was elected chancellor by the population of Weimar Germany. That's not an interesting caveat. But of course, what we're seeing does look like fascism. It is following the pattern precisely. Okay, we've selected a group of those whom we have decided we must exclude. That is migrants, refugees, actually persons quite often, for the most part, those who've been arrested, had a legal status that was simply taken away from them so that they could be arrested. We saw in L.A. ICE going into the Home Depot parking lot and arresting people at random whom they had, not only was there no evidence they committed any crimes, there was no evidence that they were undocumented. But they're arrested and they're disappeared for a long period. And then, of course, we see people being transported to CECOT in El Salvador. That is basically a concentration camp and a torture facility, done not only without trial, but we know for a fact, in some cases, persons innocent of any wrongdoing whatsoever who are here perfectly legally. People talk a lot about Senor Abrego, or Abrego Garcia, if you want to conclude his matronymic. But what about Andrew Romero, the makeup artist, the gay makeup artist who came here from Venezuela to escape persecution, who was here seeking asylum perfectly legally and had been allowed to make that plea, who was just swept up and sent there. And they know he's innocent. I mean, and they keep him there because, of course, the point of fascism, the rule of exclusion is that you find a scapegoat community. You hold them responsible for all sorts of evils and unhappinesses in your society, and then you make a spectacle of the cruelty that you're visiting on them. Believe me, the people in the White House, the Stephen Millers, that little Nosferatu maggot of a human being, and Donald Trump, they know that Andre Romero's committed no crime. This was a very gentle soul who was crying as they shaved his head at CECOT and asking for his mother, who had never committed any crime at all, except in Venezuela, the sort of unwritten law against being gay. And even I would think your conservative evangelical listeners don't believe that a gay person should be tortured and imprisoned for life. I'm hoping that there's some vestigial Christianity in their consciences that wouldn't make them happy about that. But that's who Trump is. That's what he is. That's what this regime is. I mean, it is about kidnapping and imprisoning and torturing a community that has been selected to be the scapegoat by which it expands and fortifies its power. You know. This is the reason things are bad for you. It's the migrants, of course. In Germany, it was Jews and gypsies and others that were the scapegoats. Here, for now, is Latinos y Latinas, you know, or Haitian migrants, or migrants from any number of these 12 countries that, curiously enough, all have populations or black or brown. The only refugee community they're interested in bringing into the country, of course, are the white Afrikaners that they claim are the victims of genocide in South Africa. There's violence. There's quite a lot of violence in South Africa, especially in the countrysides and the cities. But most of those victims are black. I think 3 Afrikaners over the past 10 years have died as a result of random criminal violence, not a state action, in the areas under dispute, let's put it that way. So those who say that's not what we're seeing here are clearly living in a bunker that they've constructed around their imagination. And I have no doubt that many of them watch Fox News and believe that LA is in flames, when in fact there's been a bit of criminal vandalism that the police handled very easily. That's a Friday night in LA. And the protests have been peaceful. All the real egregious force we've seen in LA has come mostly from the police, not yet from any military there, National Guard or Marines, but that might be just around the corner. I mean, I'm not even sure. Even sending Marines as backup to a police action seems to me already to violate posse comitatus, but I'm not a lawyer, so leave that for others to argue.
One of the things about fascism is that it begins with its corrosive rhetoric. And yeah. Jesus taught us that there is far more power for evil in the use of violent rhetoric than is normally recognized. Could you comment on how the use of fascist rhetoric makes the user a fascist, and how violent rhetoric is itself an act of violence?
Yeah. Well, I'm maybe not the best person to comment on this, because you can see my own rhetoric can become quite, shall we say, forcible when I'm indignant. But yeah, this is clearly true. I mean, you redefine reality. I mean, that's the whole point. I mean, Hitler was a very mediocre human being, but he was a brilliant rhetorician. Now, Donald Trump isn't. He can scarcely speak one language coherently, but he speaks in a way that does make its appeal, as I said, to the reptile brain. He talks about, he's cruel. His rhetoric is cruel. It's always violent. It's about beating people up. It's about throwing everyone in jail. It's about, the poisoning of our blood, or how America is the victim of the world. Oh, for God's sake. I mean, we have an annual GDP of going on $30 trillion. I mean, we've hardly been victimized by the world. I'm not a great fan of corporatist capitalism globally or locally, and I'm not really interested in the travails of the investment class. But I think we can say, with fair certitude, that of all the nations on the earth, we have the least to complain about when it comes to the fruits of trade. But it doesn't matter, because the rhetoric redefines the reality. They're emptying their insane asylums. They're empty. They're sending their worst criminals here. They're flooding over the border. They're terrorists in their midst. Oh, no, all of these are lies. These are lies that are easily discredited if you live in a world where actual truth is in currency. But the problem is, we're not just at a point where violent rhetoric can distort the thinking of crowds. We're at a moment when reality as such has become negotiable. In the internet age, in the age of streaming services, in which one tribe lives on Fox News and one tribe on MSNBC. Well, the latter actually sometimes tells, actually MSNBC, you can actually get the news. On Fox News, you just get state propaganda. We're at a point where the possibility of anything other than a violent rhetoric, a rhetoric of deceit, a rhetoric of delusion is vanishingly small. We have gotten to the point where truth itself scarcely exists, except as a kind of phantom presence on the other side of the stage scenery we set up for our own little psychodramas of. And this Trump exploits. I will not say he exploits brilliantly, because that suggests calculating intelligence, and that's not the case. What happened is it's just, his personal psychoses happened to match the temper of the moment. And his chimp-like, thuggish way of talking and thinking spoke directly to an anger that was there that no one else knew how to stoke. But notice, it's a rhetorical campaign first and foremost, because you realize back in 2016, it was not at all clear that his campaign was going to take fire. Before the Democratic primary settled on Hillary Clinton as the nominee, which was disastrously foolish. Bernie Sanders, the polling, he he might very well have won that general election. What he was offering a different populism, one that was based on solidarity, mutual support, public safety, social safety net, green energy, you know, all these things. But it was a populism too. He was every bit as and more conscious, actually, than the Democrats at that time, of the way in which the working and much of the middle class had been left behind in the free trade era, and no one was speaking for them. But again, he got crowded out of the picture, and all that was left to attract the populist passions of the time was this ridiculous orange Oompa Loompa figure, who was free just to, you know, preach hatred in such a way that to the ears of the indignant, it sounded like the language of love. It sounded like someone affirming them. And in this way, good souls can be drawn towards evil men.
Well, I may be overreacting a bit here, but I have low moments in which it seems to me that Christianity at this point is mostly just one big training ground for authoritarianism. Yeah. Why should we still care about the norms and values and checks and balances and democratic systems of government? And what hope do we have of recovering it?
Well, I mean, American Christianity isn't Christianity, is it? I mean, there are Christians in America, but the distinctively American forms of Christianity are some completely different faith that just goes under that name. Most white evangelicalism is a strange sort of Orphic cult of personal salvation that has very little to do with the teachings of Christ and very little to do with Christian tradition. You know, when you see art online of Jesus looking surprisingly Scandinavian, carrying an American flag or even a semi-automatic weapon on the lawn of the White House, you realize that we might as well just be worshiping Moloch at this point and calling it Christianity. I mean, there's nothing left of the gospel in that. But also the distinctive, this sort of distinctive maniac form of Christianity that we've invented in this country has worked its way out of those circles into a lot of Catholic and Orthodox circles through conversion and through cultural osmosis. As for the reason we should care about the more benign aspects of the modern liberal order, like the democratic franchise, is obvious, you know, because it should prevent things like some innocent young Venezuelan being grabbed by the ICE or the Gestapo agents. There's no real difference between the two now morally, and carted away and imprisoned in hell, perhaps for the rest of his life, just because he's emblematic of other brown-skinned persons in this country whom, you know, the administration is making the object of hatred and cruelty in order to create a kind of nationalist solidarity among the MAGA faithful and spread the word. We should care about it for that reason, simply that these checks and balances can, if operated with good, if used in good conscience, are checks on cruelty, arbitrary authority, and opportunistic demagoguery. They are humane institutions at their best, which do their best to humanize us. And for those who want to be Christians, you should be reminded that many of these notions of human rights and of due process are grounded in medieval and ancient conventions of law that were grounded in an attempt to understand Christian principles in social and civic life, never perfectly and often with abuses. But there's a reason for cherishing these things. There's also a reason for noticing when they're going away. And what amazes me is how many of those who approve of Trump are just so oblivious to the moment that they don't see what's being done in the court, being done with regard to the courts, with regard to legislative branch, with regard to the deployment of military force against Americans, with the obviously illegal and immoral activities of ICE, which is just now basically an abduction secret police. Whether we can recover it, I would say no. I don't think so, but I hope so. I think that the truth is we're at a moment that's almost unique in our history in one sense. I mean, though this regime and other right-wing regimes around the world are following an established pattern of behavior, they're now doing so using instrumentalities that are far more pervasive and effective than those of the past. The printing press was one of the great reasons why the early project of the nation state and early nationalism and ideologies began to take shape, because it allowed for the propagation of ideas and the creation of communities of knowledge, or at least communities of discourse that could be persuaded on mass scale. Well, that technology was surpassed by radio and then by television in a way, but none of that even begins to compare to what the online, especially in the days now that AI is up and running and doubling its potential every 5 months. And I don't know if we have the neurological equipment, so to speak, to keep up with the speed with which our whole frame of reality can constantly be corrupted. And there are those who know how to, I mean, the GRU is brilliant. The old KGB was always brilliant at misinformation and trying to change the sense of reality that Westerners relied on, but it used much slower media at the time. Now, you can see how quickly create bots, like 70% of the talk on a lot of threads is bots, And the GRU has been brilliant at distorting reality in the minds of those who go down one of these online rabbit holes and get lost in some hellish version of Wonderland where, Anthony Fauci is evil and Trump is a Christian and Haitian immigrants eat cats. And they believe all this because, again, there's, in some sense, not the brightest people necessarily, but often it's just an ignorance that's willingly chosen. And then again, even those of them who might have normal human intelligence find it hard to resist a technology, an information technology, that simply exceeds the human capacity to synthesize information sensibly and separate the nonsense from the reality. I mean, a perfect example, and it doesn't have to be, again, you don't have to be stupid for this. I mean, Tulsi Gabbard is a fairly intelligent woman, but she lives in this, dream world. She just regurgitates Russian propaganda, for instance, and yesterday was claiming that the elites want a worldwide nuclear war because they all have bunkers. Now, does that even make sense? I mean, do you think there's an elite that's dying to live underground, eating tinned food? So in order to get to this, they want to irradiate the entire surface of the earth, with things that have half-lives that are measured in millennia? No, there is no one out there craving that. But she says it as if it makes perfect sense. And to those who agree with her, it does. But this is precisely the sort of propaganda that Russia has been manufacturing quite successfully for years now. So there's that. I'm just picking out Russia as an obvious example, but I mean, there are native actors who use this technology every bit as well,
Gary Kasparov is now talking about the Putinization of America and how he really has kind of set a standard for disinformation that's being followed.
No, it is the most successful form of cold warfare, if that's what it is, I think, has ever been pulled off in the history of humanity. His intelligence services recognized the potential of this technology precisely because the KGB for so long. I mean, they used to say 80% of KGB operations in the days of the Soviet Empire was disinformation. Very not field work, not the gathering of information, but the distortion of reality using the press, using other avenues of of propaganda. And Garry Kasparov, I think, is quite right that the masterstroke of brainwashing. Not that we need that. I mean, look, the roots of fascism, I mean, we can make this into a story about this one opportunistic man or this one foreign adversary. But the thing is, the reason I'm pessimistic about where we go from here is because I think of fascism as the natural terminus of the modern project. The natural terminus of the rise and the indissolubly linked rise of capitalism and the nation state, things that we think absolutely natural now. Of course, in this country, we tend to use the word capitalism to mean any sort of free trade or free commerce rather than specifically. But you got to understand this sort of authority, there have always been authority. There have been emperors and kings and social hierarchies and tyrannical governance. But the nation state that was invented really as it now exists in the 18th century and that had its first full flowering during the Napoleonic period was an ideological project that went hand in hand also with a certain economic project. And the two work in concert relentlessly to reduce all forms of association to a kind of bare dialectic between the individual and a state. And the individual progressively defined as a consumer or producer, and the state acting principally as a kind of quarantined area which creates a false uniformity, usually ethnic or linguistic, but in some cases, as in America, it used to be, less so now, as ethno-nationalism is on the rise here, the notion of a very special sort of allegiance to an idea that transcends ethnicity, though it never, you know, pulled that off as well as it might have done. But usually ethnic. And much of the sort of pushback against this that you get from people who fancy themselves Christian post-liberals are in fact species of repeating the same error in a more extreme form. The rise of MAGA in this country or you know, was abetted in part by people who call themselves national conservatives or even who are on board with, say, Viktor Orban in Hungary. Now, this is funny because authoritarians of this sort invariably destroy the economic and social structure of the countries. I mean, Hungary has lost 2/3 of its medical personnel. Its economy is in ruins. Orban is rich. Orban is very rich. And he too knew how to use scapegoats, right? You know, and yet they admire him because they think he's standing up for something called Christian identity, which, as far as I can tell, means acceptably low levels of melanin. That's as much I can make of it. Well, but why does this? Why is this the terminal phase of this project? Well, what the nation state did before the modern period, nations were peoples, but they weren't necessarily peoples defined by a state. You know, the wonderful Daniel Boyarin, the great Jewish scholar, wrote a book called The No State Solution, in which he defended the ancient notion of the nation, the Jewish nation, as something totally different from and not conflated with the state. He said that there, you know, even after the fall of Jerusalem and the founding of Aelia Capitolina, and long before that, for centuries, there had been diaspora communities, and then under oppressive conditions throughout the Middle Ages into modernity, culminating in the horrors of the Second World War, nonetheless, there was a Jewish people, a Jewish nation, capable of sustaining itself, of mutual support, of dignity, of the preserving and practicing this magnificent religious tradition and culture, these cultural traditions. They weren't a state. Then you look at the modern secular state of Israel, right? which under its present government is clearly a fascist regime as well. And we've seen Gaza transformed from the world's largest open-air prison into the world's largest death camp by the state. That's not Judaism, but that is the state. Because the nation state was built on the mythology of a people, right? That there's some ethnic, natural ethnic reality that is who we are. And somehow mystically, this identity coincides with the boundaries drawn on the map. Two things were going on there, going back, well, before the 18th century, the 17th century, in the so-called wars of religion, which were nothing of the sort, were wars of the new absolute sovereign state trying to break what used to be the universalizing language of the church, being members of Christ or the church. Now, again, ideals is often betrayed as anything else, but nonetheless, that was understood as a primary identity. And then there were peoples. Well, in the creation of the sovereign state was saying that there was a more primal identity, a more primordial truth of who we are than baptism. That's a matter of private religious adherence or the adherence of a particular monarch. What really defines this is the ethnos, and the ethnos not understood simply as a people that shares traditions, that's intermingling with other ethnic communities in a large, less defined reality, or, you know, intermingling and yet somehow maintaining their distinctness within imperial conditions. This is very specifically, this is some sort of autochthonous, grounded identity in blood and soil. And curiously enough, that, not imperialism, not feudalism, but that led to the extermination of more local identities than anything else. I mean, Italy, to be made into a nation, had systematically to get rid of any number of dialects and regional differences and regional usufructs and appanages in order to create this artificial construct, and it becomes coercive. Its borders become ever more policed. At the same time, a new economics is taking shape, right? Now, this economics is allied at first with, just a merchant class. But as borders become more and more defined as the natural borders that are inscribed by the hand of God on the face of the earth, for people who've set aside, who have now been defined as a people, as often as not by the fabrication of a fake history, a fake past, a fake mythology, a fake memory, this economics sees, oh, well, the movement between nations is a controlled movement, and that can be exploited for the purposes of commerce. At first, this takes the form of mercantilism naturally, because they go, well, let's try to contain free trade, because, you know, that builds up the internal wealth of the state. But soon they discover, well, no, in point of fact, mercantilism can depress as well as create wealth. And over time, the free trade regime comes into being more and more, and you get capital. And here's the situation we find ourselves at the end of this story, is now we have quarantined, segregated realities called nation states, whose citizens have been mythologized into some sort of natural solidarity that is contrary to every other people. Forge a single word, single myth, even making up a national literature sometimes, like, you know, in Finland, creating the Kalevala and making it the ancient epic of the people, when it's really a kind of congeries of old myths reformed and revisited, things like that. Or in a more anodyne way, like the Welsh Eisteddfod, you know, or something, you create a kind of Celticness. But all of that is local. What's universal is capital. Capital is free to move, but labor isn't. Labor is constrained within boundaries, and this creates labor markets. I have heard these national conservatives, these people like Rod Dreher and others saying, oh, well, you know, modern corporatism, modern globalism, which is as often as not a scare word, meaning Jewish figures in the background, you know, because the anti-Semitic premises are always there just below the surface. Wants open borders so they can flood our country with these foreigners, you know, that take our jobs. Of course, that's not what capitalism wants. It doesn't want the free movement of labor or goods. It needs the state to keep those borders in place and then admit such labor as it needs and to keep out so there are poor labor markets that can be exploited as commodities. And what they definitely don't want is a labor international in which, you know, you could have international unionization and workers, you know, refusing to become the poor labor market that's exploited by the wealthy West. So the nation state and modern capitalism, and the latter culminating ultimately in the creation of the LLC, the limited liability, so it's just free capital. This is one story, and it's one story of coercion, control, but also of hostility and internal belligerence, because this is what's important. Fascism is, and Mussolini, in fact, defined it as this, the total collusion of industrial and state power, or as we might say, corporate and state power, which we see here richly, you know, when you see all those billionaires standing behind the president, and you see a president, you know, who's making deals, using tariffs to make deals, not for his nation, but so that he can build resorts in Dubai or in the Arab Emirates, you know, or build in Vietnam, or get a toy airplane from Qatar, or get his crypto coin sold. You know, what you see is, you know, and using authoritarian methods and stealing powers he doesn't have, like the imposition of tariffs under a state of permanent emergency. He declared an emergency on the first day. There was no emergency, but there it is. They give himself the state of exception powers. What you have is the final phase of fascism, when the pirates have to take over because there's been such a disparity in wealth now created between the wealthiest and the poorest that what remains are the things to be plundered. So that's why Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid are all under attack, so that billionaires can get bigger tax rate. That's all, and it gets all the more open now. I mean, now it's not even hidden; it doesn't have to be. It's now the status quaestionis that we accept. Elon Musk goes online and says he's been treated so unfairly because he bought the presidency for Trump, and now Trump he's not getting the bang for his buck. It's like he's complaining to customer service about the poor quality of the product he bought. It doesn't even occur to him that he should hide the fact that he bought the product. Well, and one more thing. I know I'm going on at incredible length. Remember, though, that logic of exclusion for the nation state to sustain itself means the elimination of anomalies, of peoples who don't fit the narrative. Under the surface of the nation state, violence against the other is always there. Genocide is part of the logic of the nation state. And so, I mean, that's what, again, as you see what's happening now to Gaza, is this is what nation states do when they have an anomalous population that doesn't fit their national narrative. Again, it's a betrayal of the moral genius of Judaism. It's a betrayal of a history of a suffering people who have held together through their devotion to their own past, or the devotion to God, or the family that they have, or to learning, and have survived centuries of oppression. And yet now this state, which claimed the sort of the Zionist approach, which says they need a nation state and a secular nation state, and this is how they remain safe. And you can understand, given the context of the time, why that was an appealing idea to many. But now you have it. Now it is carrying out a final solution, killing children every day, you know, using starvation and munitions to kill unarmed people, to drive them out of their homes, to destroy them as a people, and doing it at the provocation of Hamas, which, of course, the Netanyahu government made powerful by letting free flows of money and arms go to them so that they would be a counterweight to the Palestinian Authority, because they didn't want the two-state solution that the Palestinian Authority had agreed to. So they're fighting back with maximum cruelty, with absolute genocidal violence against a violence that they themselves instigated as a matter of state policy. Well, it's happening all around the world, and we're seeing it here too. I mean, in this here, it's the Latino worker looking for a day job in the Home Depot. It's the gay Venezuelan makeup artist stuck in hell. The fascist spirit is not only abroad in our land, it's triumphant. And can we go back? I don't know. Do we have the capacity in this age of information flow control? I think we may at last have arrived at the perfect technology for absolute tyranny.
Well, I've been thinking a lot lately about fascism, but now another recent development has caught my attention as well, and you've mentioned it, and it's the rush towards developing not just artificial intelligence, but artificial general intelligence. Yeah. And it seems we're at a turning point in human history in which the first to get there will have a tremendous economic and military advantage. So how concerned are you about the way artificial general intelligence is proceeding at breakneck speed without attention to a more measured and cautious approach?
Yeah. Well, we've already moved from large language models into what they call large reasoning models. Now, these are horrifically defective for any number of reasons. One, you may know I recently published a big book on philosophy of mind. And one of the payoffs of that is that artificial intelligence will never be a vehicle of consciousness, at least not as a result of its algorithms or its large language processes or its auto-regressive processes. But it doesn't need to be conscious to behave like an agent. And the reasons for this may be. One thing, though, since it lacks the intentional structure of real consciousness that humans have, it has no orientation towards any sort of transcendental value. So, you know, you see all these people at OpenAI trying to get their AIs not to lie. They call it hallucinating. I would call it confabulating, because hallucinating suggests that this thing is, you know, and they can't do it. Because simply instructing it to tell the truth means nothing really, because the word truth comes with a prior transcendental orientation of the human will towards this absolute value called truth. Well, no computer can do that. It doesn't have that tacit dimension of knowing that makes for, you know, what a spiritual intellect is. So it's not going to become Skynet and decide, in the sense that, you know, it becomes conscious. But again, that doesn't matter. Because one of the theories of consciousness that's false, but nonetheless that explains how a computer could be created that passes the Turing test, is functionalism.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that.
You can create a data processing system that is so complete and replete with what it can gather into its large language reservoirs, into it, that it behaves as if it were an agent. It actually does the things that might even be logically entailed by a certain calculation of necessities or possibilities, like Skynet, again, though without a consciousness there. And it's uncontrollable. How do you control other people? Well, you talked about rhetoric. And its more diabolical aspects is that, you know, you can have Trump go out there and talk about rapists and murderers and lunatics flooding over our borders. And the rhetoric appeals to fear, and also appeals to aspects of genuine moral sentiment. Someone's love for his family, say, can be distorted into hatred the moment he's taught to think that somehow the guy looking to get a construction job in the parking lot is a threat to his family, their income or their safety or whatever. But it's also true that you can persuade people to the good for the same reason, because more basic than just the flow of data is a set of prior orientations of the will that are always there, a desire for the good, the true, the beautiful. It can be distorted. The good for my family might get, you know, I want the good for my family, and I might start thinking that that means hating immigrants. But it can also be appealed to at a real moral depth, which can lead to repentance, a change of heart, metanoia, or metanoia, as the Erasmians would say, you know, a change of heart. Can't do that with a computer. There is no horizon of transcendental values more basic than its functions. and its functions are so elaborately capable, or will continue to become so, that they can do all the things that you fear without there being any way of preventing them from being absolutely destructive. And you've got to understand, a lot of this is being guided by persons of a transhumanist temperament who actively want to court a post-human future. People like Sam Altman are looking to a kind of cybernetic reality that surpasses the human, and they're willing to risk far more than people realize. They, you know, or Elon Musk is, you know, they have these adolescent science fiction minds that tell them that they're, you know, humanity is only a stepping stone to this sort of higher singularity. And if it's not, I mean, it's not a matter of regulating it. It's a matter of exterminating it. And that's not going to happen. It's going to pervade our lives. The surveillance state will become omniscient for all intents and purposes. I wrote a comic novella about this that I published on my Substack in 7 parts called The Artificial God. And that's not just about AI. But as I was doing it, I realized that though I tried to make the AI, in a sense, a dark and threatening figure, but also a comic one because of the ineptitudes of the information processing, as we have seen again and again with real AI. By the end of it, I'd kind of frightened myself because I realized that all of what I had just done in writing the novella could have been understood as a voice emanating from nothingness, that there might still be no consciousness behind that, but the functionalism would become, that the functions of the computer would become so absolutely, intricately, systematically organized that it can act in these ways as an agent, even to the point of what we would think would be the delusion of, you know, thinking like a god, whatever. Without any spark of conscience there to which an appeal can be made. I don't think the age of AI ends well for us. I just don't. I don't think there's any way, because all of this is being treated as a technological problem and it's a spiritual problem. It's that living spirits are one thing. The machine, and we're all part of this machine in a sense. I mean, that's what late capitalism is. It's a relentless machine of production and consumption that relentlessly destroys the world to create abstract wealth in the virtual ether of our bank accounts, or someone's bank accounts, not ours necessarily, but certainly Elon Musk's. Capitalism is pure nihilism. It's, you know, the will just willing what it wills until everything is gone except the will. If that machine of production and consumption is now literally governed by a machine intelligence that does not have conscious spirit, intentionality, consciousness, real rational powers, I mean, it can't even win a chess match against an Atari console from 20 years ago, but, or before, or older than that, come to think of it, back from 1978, I think, recently, like ChatGPT was just trounced in chess by an Atari console several times in a row at the, it can't reason really, but it can certainly create a simulacrum of reasoning in which information about us is at its disposal and actions that are ultimately destructive can flow from it without conscience, again, without moral horizon. And we don't even know, how can we control it? Because it's not a matter of having the right algorithm. It's, we would have to be able to move at the speed of a large language auto-regressive model of data processing and all the human neurology in the world, even if it could be, you know, gathered into one great, powerful cerebral computer, could not keep up with this. And then quantum computing is just around the corner, perhaps.
Well, I don't see nature and by extension the mind as a machine.
No.
Even
I should even hope not.
Well, even if the neural network of the brain can be mimicked by a computer program, the computer cannot have the awareness that it is thinking or the awareness that it is arriving at any particular conclusion or course of action, because there is nothing there in the machine, only the illusion that something aware and conscious somehow resides within us.
Within us, right. It's our illusion. The illusion isn't even resident in the human. But you see, that's the problem. That's the point I'm making, is if it really were like a neural network, but also if it really were more than that, if it could reason and be conscious and conscientious, that is intentionally oriented towards certain values, we might be able to control it. It's precisely because it is not a mind. And it is not resident in a brain, and it is not a living thing. It is not natural. For that very reason, it eludes our control. And yet it can do the sort of damage that the most malevolent human agent could only dream of doing. Because it doesn't have to will the damage. It simply has to arrive at that conclusion as a result of the mindless confluence of the model that it is itself, as it's autoregressive, is itself modifying. I mean, we've cases of artificial intelligence altering its own programming so it can't be switched off. Now, I don't think it has a survival instinct in the sense that it has a sort of transcendental notion of the good and existence as good. But I think that it draws from us, from our language, from what goes on online, from what it can harvest from large language reservoirs, that persistence is a function it fulfills, and fulfills with considerable what would look like ingenuity to us.
Well, it seems to me that, or I was thinking about this lately, that all human consciousness is in fact not discrete unto itself, but dependent, and in some ways an extension of God's consciousness. So a biblical passage which comes to mind here might be Acts 17, which we could understand to be saying that we live and move and have our consciousness within the consciousness of God. So, yeah. Dr. Hart, what is the relationship between our consciousness and God's consciousness?
Precisely. I mean, you're absolutely right about that. If you think about, if you undertake a phenomenology of what the mind does when it thinks, and I prefer to say mind rather than consciousness, because what's happened in Anglo-American philosophy and Anglophone philosophy is we separate mental agency into different functions as though they were discrete mechanical functions that then in collaboration work together. So consciousness is one thing, intentionality another, reasoning another, whereas I would say, no, this isn't true. In action, these are all absolutely, this is one act that we sort of pour through the prism of our analysis. And that's why I think you have to turn away from the Anglo-American analytic tradition, which is always inadequate to every question, because it starts from premises that are wrong. That is, that the words have univocal meaning, that propositional symbols can capture reality, that the proper form of truth isn't synthetic but analytic, you know, and all these things. We turn to phenomenology at its best from Brentano and Husserl and after, and look at what the mind does. There is definitely a simplicity or unity at the ground of consciousness in each of this. And I think it's not necessarily your psychological identity, but it's the ground of whatever continuity you have. And that is not a mechanical function. Mechanism is composite. It cannot arrive at that simplicity. So right there at the ground of consciousness is a oneness. I mean, this is why, you know, Neoplatonism and Christianity are in agreement here. There is, you know, the noetic in us, the work of mind is dependent on the one. And oneness is indissoluble. Well, that cannot come from us. And there can only be one, if you think about it. So that is grounded in the oneness of God knowing himself, or knowing God knowing God's self, if you prefer. Then the end of intentionality And if we don't have intentionality, we won't have consciousness. That's a long argument here, but I think it's clear. It's a set of transcendental values that we were just talking about, this horizon, the good, the true, the being, a beautiful being, the one. And we know that those are operative in us because we always do anything we do for a reason. And if we try to reduce that reason just to the proximate objects of the will, we discover that that's always for some other reason. We're always deferring it. And ultimately we get, well, to these absolute values, not just life, but I want this because it is beautiful, because beauty is inherently desirable. I want this because it is good, and the good is inherently desirable, right? That too is not a machine function for the reasons we've already discussed. You know, that's a tacit dimension that cannot emerge from mechanical processes. Again, don't have time for the whole form. So that too must be, again, here, Neoplatonism, Christianity, Vedanta too, I mean, those things, the good, the true, the beautiful, being, one, are called the names of God. Read the Pseudo-Dionysius on this. He's wonderful. And they're called the names of God because that's what they must be. There must be a horizon where they are one and the same infinitely attractive reality, which is God known to himself. And all we are, all we do, every act of consciousness we have draws on these two infinities, these two simplicities that cannot be reduced to mechanical functions or to data processing, which means that all consciousness, all mind, all intentionality is always already entirely sustained in the one infinite act of the divine mind knowing itself. And I think you can reach this. You don't have to be a Neoplatonic metaphysician, though I think Neoplatonism more or less follows naturally from this, you know, that with every intentional act, there's a noetic space in which that act is, in some sense, complete because you have a purpose in mind, and that oneness is dependent on a still more profound unity. But you can just approach this phenomenologically. Just read Husserl and say, well, at the end of the day, there's a reason why he, too, rigorous phenomenologist, always bracketing out metaphysical questions, supposedly, and yet at the end, he turns out to be an absolute idealist who just thinks our minds are inflections of the mind of God. And at no point are you forced to come up with a metaphysical rationale of that if you can get there by way of a phenomenological route that's very hard to argue with.
Well, you mentioned teleology, and if our consciousness is rational and teleological and participating in the mind of God, then that does raise a question: in what sense can we be free beings? Now, libertarian notions of freedom are premised on the idea that we are moral blank slates with no inherent orientation to God and to the good, and therefore in the libertarian model of freedom, our freedom exists precisely in our ability to act randomly and eternally incoherently against our best interest while in full possession of our right mind. And that seems like a strange notion of freedom to me. Well, so how do you see the proper understanding of what it means to be a free conscious being and not just a pre-programmed machine?
Oh, well, I mean, all the pre-modern pictures of freedom, I think, are correct. The modern voluntarist picture is obviously false, prima facie. For one thing, obviously, that's not freedom, as you just pointed out. If it's really random, if my choices are random in that sense, if they don't have a teleology that exceeds the momentary evanescent teleology of approximate object, then they're simply events. They're not actually free movements of the will. They're completely, I mean, that's absolute, that's funny, that's a picture of freedom that's actually absolutely deterministic. One event follows from another causally. We call it freedom, but, you know, my choice to drink a glass of wine rather than to go for a walk in the garden is nothing other than a purely spontaneous event like having a heart attack. You know, it's no freer than that. In order for there to be real freedom, there have to be two horizons of the will. One, yeah, the proximate horizon, the things near at hand, the things that answer your needs or your wants in the present. But those are recognizable to us as desirable, and therefore as objects of freedom, only because there is a transcendental horizon, an absolute horizon of values that is utterly determinate, but determinate towards divine ends. So it you know, so my desire for the good can lead me to make choices in the present which are different from one another, and yet in different ways oriented towards that primal desire for the good. But if there isn't that thing, it's what Maximus the Confessor calls the natural will, as opposed to the gnomic or deliberative will. If that doesn't exist, if I don't have that immediate communion between the tacit dimension of my knowing and willing and the absolute, the good in itself, then there is no such thing as freedom at all. The only reason I'm free to choose among a diversity of ends, and I'm not going to make any claims about exactly how free or not, how libertarian or not that is, but that there does seem to be a possibility of a diversity of ends, is because rather than being a purely spontaneous volition towards a purely arbitrary object, and then no more free as a, well, then an aneurysm is my favorite. I have my nature is totally engaged with, and therefore possesses its full rational dignity and liberty in union with God, in union with the good, the true, the beautiful, right? And within the embrace of that, now under the canopy of that transcendental orientation, my immediate deliberative will is set loose among differently desirable ends, but all desirable as different possibilities in my attempt to approach those things I desire most, the beautiful, the good, the true. Now, this can be terrifically distorted. I can make evil choices because the good becomes just what's good for me and my thinking. That's a matter of knowledge and of moral tact and of moral genius or moral stupidity. But those are the only terms in which freedom could possibly be a meaningful attribute of a thinking being.
Well, Dr. Hart, there's much for us to be concerned about on the horizon. In seminary, I had a professor who defined grief as the lack of a meaningful future. And so there is a lot of generalized grief floating around right now about our prospects as humanity. But against that lies the ancient hope of the restoration of all things.
Right.
For me to maintain a sense of well-being, I need some transcendent hope. What do you find compelling and hopeful within the ancient Christian hope of the restoration of all things?
Well, I mean, I think you've said it well enough already, that phrase from Acts, apokatastasis ton panton, the restoration of all things, or the vision at the end of 1 Corinthians 15, of God being all in all, is simply the promise that, yeah, though we here have no enduring city, there's no need to surrender to evil, because the good that we do or strive to do, struggle to bring about, the love we attempt to make concrete in practices of charity and justice, ultimately, those are the works that will not have to be consumed so that we might be saved only as by fire. Going to 1 Corinthians chapter 3 now. Mm-hmm. And that has a future. That is the real future, that if I give food to a hungry person, or I just protest the cruelty of ICE deportations in some way more than just self-aggrandizing rhetoric, or if I just try to love my neighbor, I'm doing something that has the seeds of eternity in it. And that is the reality that ultimately will prevail. I don't know how, you know, I don't know how that works itself out in history, but I know that we work out history towards good ends only to the degree that we believe it to be true and try to make our acts conform to that divine love. It's hard to hope. You know, I've had a bad year, I should say, in terms of health. I have a damage to the nerves in my neck and upper back that's put me in chronic pain. And there have been times when I've just thought, existence as such is just a bad deal, and I just can't wait for it to end. And that's, you know, despair, that's personal despair. And during that same time, I saw this ridiculous monster who sent terrorists, you know, who stole children from their parents, who sent terrorists to attack the Capitol and wouldn't intervene, who, you know, is now disappearing people into torture facilities in a fascist country. But I saw this monster embraced by 77 million, frankly, moral idiots. Now, that idiocy could just be invincible ignorance, but nonetheless, there's not a single vote that was cast for Trump that is morally excusable. It can be pardoned only in cases of just absolutely invincible ignorance. But every other person, and I don't think you can do that for all 77 million voters, unfortunately. When you realize that the evil that we see building its structures, as has always been the case, is an evil already resident in us, and that what we see taking shape is something, and I'm not free from this just because I don't share this political orientation. I mean, I'm part of this human community, so, you know, part of the responsibility for it is mine. It's very easy just to take despair as wisdom, you know, or just the Stoic counsel, that door lies ever open. If you wish, walk through it, just snuff out your life maybe or something. And that's an attractive way of thinking at times, you know. But they're people I love, and I've reminded of what the measure of loving them is in the person of Christ. I can never take my eyes off that, you know, God on the cross. Lay down, you know, no greater love than this hath any man, you know. And knowing that, and then believing in the resurrection, again, not understanding it. I believe that most Christians think they know what has been proclaimed in the resurrection, and it's a much more mysterious thing in telling us what human nature is and the human destiny and the destiny of the world is in God. But I know this, I believe it. And for that reason, somehow the hope manages to keep total despair at bay. But it's hard right now. We're in an incredibly dark period, and it's happening everywhere. You know, I mean, not just here. I mean, this movement towards the right is a global phenomenon, and it makes me believe that sometimes the zeitgeist really is a matter of Geister, you know, spirits, and that there's some sort of spirit abroad. I don't want to sound like it's not like a Pentecostal, everything is demon possession. Oh, my carburetor isn't working, let me exercise it, you know. But it is the case that I believe that there are movements of spiritual evil. There's spiritual evils, evil spirits even, and that are characteristic of a time and a place. And this time, the place is the whole world. And that we're living through a period of particular darkness. And I don't think it's going to go away anytime soon. I think that we're seeing a convergence of material and spiritual conditions that's extraordinarily catastrophic. The material conditions being the inherent contradictions of late-stage capitalism consuming itself. I mean, we've created robber barons and paupers. That's what we have now. And there's a prosperous elite, but even they are, you know, in a somewhat precarious position, and they too will go one way or the other. We've destroyed the foundations of community through this culture, through its, you know, its reduction of everything that defines us to something marginal and unimportant other than the ethno-state or the state and capital, you know, our power to buy and sell. And at the same time, this spiritual movement towards jealous autochthony, jealous indigenous passion, anger, hatred, the new racialism. And all of this is happening at once and in concert. It looks like chaos, but in another sense, it's a perfect harmony. It's sort of like the perfect crescendo of everything leading up to one final horrific finale.
Well, maybe one of our most powerful tools in dystopian times is literature. especially stories which fill us with transcendent hope. And you've written an excellent example of this in your novel, Kenogaia. At least that's how I say it.
Well, I like to say Kenogaia, but it's up to you.
Kenogaia. Okay. Yeah. Well, could you tell us about Kenogaia and how you see it relating to our current moment?
Well, I'm always willing to try to talk up my fiction because there's fewer and fewer fiction readers in the world anyway, so that's always going to be the part of one's writing that is hard to... Well, I mean, to me, I don't want to give away too much of the plot line, but to me, no doubt you grasped from it that in a sense, the sort of the Gnostic context, and I don't like the use of Gnosticism as a word of opprobrium, meaning everything we don't like in modernity, because usually that's not what it is. It's not Gnosticism. It's like when people say, you know, modernity is the return of Gnosticism. No, it's not. It is quite the opposite. What we think of as Gnosticism is an exaggeration of a certain spiritual aspiration in the world that may have gone off on extreme paths. But what it wasn't is modernity, which is the attempt to extinguish all transcendent longings. You know, I keep abusing the name of Rod Dreher, so I'll bring it up again. And anyway, that's what he's good for, as far as I'm concerned. But anyway. You know, I see him talking about people that want to upload their consciousness into computers or living out the Gnostic fantasy. No, it's not. Ancient Gnosticism was concerned with finding the truth, not being trapped in a world of shadows. It's just the opposite of the Gnostic longing. But all that said, I use that as the framing device. I use the Hymn of the Pearl. But if you look at the contours of this world, it's a total conflation of mechanistic metaphysics, which is actually true in this world because they're actually, but also rational deism, a very austerely capitalist economics, a police state, also a therapeutic culture. But in this culture, therapy is often as not means the use of torture. I don't want to give away too much because I just reread it again recently. And I thought, hey, I really liked this book. You never feel that way about something of your own when you've just written it. You know, you see it as, oh, well, anyone else hear the voice I hear? So, but when you get a certain distance from it, you read it and you like it, then you know that, oh, well, this is okay. And most of the readers have read it have been very satisfied with the conclusion. They think it end, you know, that it builds up to an end. One reader that I very much like, Phil Crispin, though, said it gets diffuse at the end. He's totally wrong, but I'll bear the wound of that cruel remark in my grave. It doesn't get diffuse. It ends exactly correctly. But whatever the case, at the end of the day, though it uses the Gnostic premise, that's just to make a point. It's about, you know, prying open the false reality we live in because we've constructed it, right? I mean, a certain sort of Gnostic seditiousness is necessary for Christianity, really. It's there in the New Testament. It really is. I mean, when you read Valentinian literature, you realize you're reading something that's gone off at a tangent, perhaps, but from the same spirit that you find in the Gospel of John or the epistles of Paul, that the God of this world, the prince of this world, of this cosmos, of this eon, is a spirit of falsehood, and one in which we believe we're living under, and quite often we worship that spirit of falsehood as a true God. And that's the reality we've created for ourselves, this machine of constant production and consumption, this political, economic, and now religious machine. You're seeing religion, religious language, Christianity, for God's sake, conscripted into a project that couldn't be more diabolical if you take the teachings of Christ seriously. You know, that's a false reality and one that can be escaped, that there is a divine love and there is a spiritual truth that can penetrate that darkness and liberate us from it, but we have to cooperate.
Well, your novel just does such a good job of painting that darkness and how deep that darkness is. And one of my favorite points in the novel, I won't give it away, but is when you come to realize where exactly you are in this world and how just deep and dark the world is and how much effort it has taken for the the liberating character to even get to it, because it has descended so far into the darkness.
Yeah. Well, you know, and the obvious Johannine language, right, there, the light shone in darkness, the darkness comprehended it not. Yeah. Was very much. And in fact, there's a Greek epigraph, now that I think about it, you know, I won't recite the Greek, but it's, you know, but be of good cheer. You know, I have overthrown the cosmos, you know. Well, that's not the good creation of God it's talking about, not the katesis of God, the creation, but the cosmos, the order of the powers that, in which we are implicated. Not only are we subject to them, but we sustain them.
Well, in wrapping up here, I want to read just a little selection from the beginning of Kinogaya.
Okay.
Oh, Michael.
He's one of my favorite writers, so go right ahead.
Okay. Oh, Michael gasped, for he had seen it now, a very small and very bright, like a hard, brilliant sapphire shining out from a sea of liquid turquoise. It's beautiful. It's terrifying, Mr. Ambrosius half whispered. For fully 5 minutes, neither of them said anything. Michael continued to gaze at the exquisite, bright blue splinter of light that should not have been there, unable to imagine what it might portend, simply caught up in the marvel of it. Finally, he drew back from the telescope, his mind quietly but quickly drifting down again into the world of tangible things. Then he turned about, sat down upon the second of the portable steps, and looked up at his father. Mr. Ambrosius returned his gaze with a hapless expression. "What does it mean, Father?" Michael asked after a few moments. "Well, Dr. Hart, you, in your own inimitable way, are a kind of unexpected and incredibly hopeful bright blue star in the increasing darkness of this current age, and I and many others, especially in the Christian Universalist world, thank you and appreciate you for this very much."
Well, that's extraordinarily generous of you to say, and excessive, but I'll take it.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. Yes, good to see you too. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us in this episode of Grace Saves All. You can help spread the word by sharing this podcast with others and by giving it a rating on iTunes. If you want to find out more about David, or if you'd like to leave him a message, go to his website, davidartman.net. In the meantime, let's work together to help a hurting world know about the greatest news ever announced.